Today on the program, we're learning about the Nature Conservancy and in particular, why the City of Quincy has been selected to participate in their new Living Shoreline Planning Series. And we welcome to the program, Dan Goulart is here from the Nature Conservancy to tell us a little bit more about the organization, about specifically what they'd like to do here in Quincy. Dan, it's nice to meet you, first of all.
Yeah, nice to meet you too.
Appreciate the opportunity to learn about yourself, about the Conservancy, and about this Living Shoreline project in Quincy, specifically the Rock Island Marsh area, right?
I'm really excited about that,
Can we start with just a brief overview of what the Nature Conservancy is?
Sure, yeah. The Nature Conservancy is actually one of the world's largest environmental conservation organizations. Sort of has its roots as a rural land trust, but has now expanded to cover everything from the mountains down through coastal cities and out into the ocean. And it is really focused in Massachusetts on biodiversity and helping the state adapt to climate change through nature-based approaches.
So it's an international organization.
Yes.
All around the world. Over 100 years old, is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And can you maybe point to some, I guess, past projects that maybe folks could identify with to kind of understand what you do?
I think one that's really close to home here is Watson Park in Braintree.
Oh.
We played a role in that project and have highlighted it in a Living Shorelines video that's available online.
Okay.
And this project was a park that was experiencing stormwater flooding and at the same time experiencing tidal flooding and erosion from the river out front, the tidal river. And that project is now really a great example of how nature-based approaches like green stormwater management and Living Shorelines can be integrated into a beautiful public space, not only prevent flooding and erosion, but also just enhance the public use of the space. The ball fields that are there, the walking path that was installed. It's a really great project. It's nearby, and I'd encourage people to go take a look at it.
Very good. How did you yourself get involved with the Nature Conservancy, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, my background is not a traditional background. I served 30 years in the Navy.
You were a SEAL.
I was a Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
And as I was getting ready to retire, I just thought, you know, I'm kind of done with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Done jumping out of planes and running around getting shot at. And decided to pursue something that's always been a passion of mine, which is the coastal environment, preserving the coastal environment. I started out down in New Bedford with the Buzzards Bay Coalition. Spent a few years there learning the ropes after going back to school and getting a master's degree in environmental sustainability. And then this coastal project manager came up at the Nature Conservancy, and I just thought, this is a great opportunity. It will keep me connected with the ocean. I love to surf and paddle on the south coast in Buzzards Bay, and it's just been a fantastic experience getting out into communities and using nature and leveraging the power of nature to help protect, preserve, and also just enhance quality of life for people who are in areas that are experiencing some of the impacts of climate change along our coasts or have just suffered from degradation from poorly planned development. You know, bringing back more natural landscapes can help return wildlife, it can build resilience, and it just makes life in that community a little bit nicer.
Yeah, and it could have a positive economic effect also, right?
Absolutely.
Like Bedford, the whaling industry, fishing industry, right?
That's right. You know, the fishing industry, I think what a lot of people don't realize is even offshore fishing is really connected to our coast and in particular to estuaries and salt marsh environments where a lot of those fish spend their young years. It's great nursery habitat for those fish. And then they go out to sea and they become either commercially important or really recreationally important.
Certainly.
Like the striped bass.
Sure.
And you talk to a striped bass fisherman and you start talking about restoring salt marsh or eelgrass or estuarine habitat that gives that fish a place to live out its young years, and you get some big thumbs up.
Sure. So can you tell me about the Nature Conservancy's Living Shorelines Planning Series, what that is?
Yeah, so the Living Shorelines Planning Series was an idea that we came up with to, number one, increase the adoption and knowledge of living shorelines and nature-based approaches to resilience along our coasts. but also to build some capacity in municipalities and local nonprofits on how to look at a stretch of shoreline that's experiencing erosion or other climate-related impacts or storm-related impacts like flooding, and assess it for suitability for a specific type of living shoreline. And then, you know, using the knowledge they get from our consultant who's teaching the lessons along with some of us from the Nature Conservancy and the Northeast Regional Ocean Council, who's also a partner on this, is be able to assess suitability and then start planning what type of living shoreline might actually be a good fit for that location. You know, living shorelines and nature-based approaches, they have a very broad scope. Everything from restoring a vegetated sand dune to restoring a degraded salt marsh sill that's out in front of an upland area, to hybrid solutions where you restore a salt marsh, for instance, but maybe you add some natural stone along the front edge to keep it from eroding if it's experiencing a lot of high velocity water movement. Okay. So there's a lot of innovation going on in this space as well to sort of create tailored solutions for each site. And sometimes those involve, you know, a little bit of rock or a little bit of other hybrid elements, but by and large, they are natural native materials being reincorporated in to produce a positive effect for people and wildlife.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that opposed to like putting up seawalls, right, or tight gates or actual physical structures that are holding back.
Right, the hardening approach, which, you know, has sort of been our default in a lot of places for many years. And, you know, what we see around us, including in the Rock Island Marsh area, is there's been a lot of alteration, man-made alterations in their roads running across salt marshes that have that are now fragmented and separated by very small culverts, which is the only place the water can flow between the marsh fragments. And it really starts to degrade and undermine that marsh's ability to provide ecosystem services like flood protection to those communities when we fragmented out and we bring in what we call coastal squeeze, which is a lot of houses right up on the marsh, and then roads that cross it, and then culverts that restrict its water movement.
Okay. So as I mentioned, Quincy was one of only three communities in Massachusetts to receive support for this project, and only 11 and now all of New England, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a competitive process. Okay. We put out a solicitation.
I see.
Through municipal associations, through other nonprofit partners from Maine all the way to Connecticut. And we worked with the Woods Hole Group, who's our consultant on this project, and they helped us sort of vet those projects and select 11 of the best projects that we thought were within the scope and size range and also were suitable for a living shoreline. And those communities, received notification that they were selected, and we've been conducting a series of online training sessions, but also an in-person site visit at each location to, you know, not only have us, TNC, NROC, and the Woods Hole Group be able to see that site firsthand, but also to provide some additional field assessment training to those towns, you know. So I feel like every town between the northern tip of Maine and the west end of Connecticut has at least one site in town that's been eroding for decades, and they just don't really know what to do with it.
Yeah,
you know, they put some stone out there, they just sort of deal with it year over year after the winter nor'easters come through. And this series, which we hope to run future iterations of.
Okay, so is this the first one?
This is the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really modeled off of a SNEP EPA Southern New England program stormwater planning series that's been going on for many years that I actually attended a few years back and thought we could apply this same model to living shorelines and nature-based solutions. And so I reached out to EPA SNEP team who does projects all over Southeast Massachusetts.
Back to the acronyms, what's SNEP, Dan?
SNEP is the Southern New England Program under EPA.
Okay, thank you.
It's really focused on sort of from Worcester out towards Plymouth and down into Buzzards Bay and Narragansett Bay, looking at these large estuaries that have a lot of impacts from coastal development, coastal pollution runoff, providing those communities with grant funding and technical assistance on how to manage stormwater more effectively using green stormwater strategies and also doing habitat restoration.
Okay, so can we talk about the Quincy site specifically? It's
yeah,
Rock
absolutely.
Island Cove Marsh out on Housneck. For folks who need kind of landmarks, it's Linden Street, Rhoda Street area.
Rockland and Spring Street sort of branch off there where there's an outlet from the salt marsh. You know, this is an area that used to be maybe 60 to 80 acres of contiguous salt marsh before a lot of coastal development moved in and started to squeeze it between housing and then fragment it with these roads, low-lying roads that run across the marsh. You know, those roads are now at an elevation where they're experiencing flooding during king tides and storm surges. And the culverts are now restricting water movement in and out of the marsh, so the marsh is starting to degrade. You know, salt marsh likes to be flooded, and then it likes to drain really nicely. And as we go in and, you know, over the last 60, 80 years have built all along our coasts, we didn't really think about how that development might impact the ability of these natural resources to, A, survive, but B, protect us. You know, when I look at something close to home, which was, you know, Superstorm Sandy, the last really large tropical system to come up and hit sort of the New England area, intact coastal wetlands, places like the Rock Island Marsh, allowed those communities to have over $625 million in avoided damage because they were healthy, intact coastal wetlands. So, you know, being able to manage these wetlands, keep them healthy, and allow the free movement of water is really to our advantage. And we can develop nature-based approaches and strategies that can make that possible so that the people in that community and the natural resources that, they want to be out walking along the marsh and bird watching and having those beautiful places that allow for recreation and just increased quality of life, but also to have them there to protect them and absorb large storm surges and events that come through this area.
And you think this, the Rock Island Marsh area is a good place to do that?
Absolutely. Really? You know, in the town of Quincy, you know, through the Living Shorelands Planning Series, towns submitted sort of a problem area in their town, whether that was erosion or flooding or other impacts like habitat loss. And so the town of Quincy had initially submitted an outflow where sort of Spring and Rockland Street come together. There's two culverts there that discharge from the salt marsh. And after looking at that site and doing an assessment of it in the field, it was determined that there's a lot of work that needs to occur upstream before we could actually implement a living shoreline at the salt marsh that's being eroded.
Okay.
Because there's two undersized culverts, and those culverts are channeling a lot of water out of the salt marsh on every tidal cycle. And that velocity is sort of tearing the salt marsh apart. So, you know, those culverts would need to be addressed. And this is really the case in a lot of locations. There's upstream stormwater or other man-made alterations like culverts that would ideally be addressed first, and then you could come downstream and reestablish a healthy marsh system down below it.
Okay.
So when we looked at that and we did a little bit more exploration in the marsh, we found a site on Rhoda Street. There's a culvert that comes under Rhoda Street, and that was identified as a really suitable location. There had been some work done there, and that work left behind a lot of scour and bank erosion in the marsh. And our Woods Hole Group consultants and the team from TNCU came up with the people from Quincy DPW and the Conservation Department looked at that site, and that's the site we're going to focus on for this particular project.
Oh, okay. So what will actually be happening there?
So this is a site that is downstream, on the downstream side of a tidal culvert.
Okay.
That's experiencing a lot of coastal bank erosion and salt marsh erosion. And what we'll do in that site is we will reestablish the appropriate native salt marsh and high marsh vegetation along the edges of that bank, and then provide perhaps some armored towing using natural stone to help that bank stay in place and help water flow through, so we don't see continued erosion mm-hmm. of that land that could eventually come back and threaten the roadway.
Okay, so does that mean removing the culvert that's there now?
No, that culvert is going to stay in place.
Okay.
You know, ultimately the roads that cross the marsh at Rota Street are going to need to be elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when that happens, which, you know, we know that's a large capital expense the city. When that does happen, then that culvert could potentially be enlarged to meet sort of the Massachusetts culvert standards, to be slightly wider. And when we widen the culverts, we allow that water to flow more freely, but it also reduces the velocity.
I see.
So we don't get as much scour and erosion. You know, and when we see that erosion, that sediment and that cloudy water that's full of suspended sediment because it's moving quickly, that moves out into the outer parts of Quincy Harbor and Boston Harbor, and then degrades our habitat out there.
Okay.
So that's how we see things like loss of our eelgrass beds, is through all that suspended sediment coming downstream, cloudy water, higher nitrogen levels, and that impacts everything moving outwards, whether it's shellfish beds or eelgrass meadows. Those things have been lost over time because of sort of the impacts of coastal development. You know, none of that is irreversible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It just takes time, it takes planning, it takes funding from, you know, both the town, the state, federal grant resources to come in and slowly plan this out. And, you know, interwoven in all of this is community resilience to sea level rise and larger, more intense, more frequent storms.
Yeah. So who's actually doing the actual physical work, Dan, and how is it being paid for?
So, you know, the Living Shorelines Planning Series is going to produce a concept design, or what we call a 30% design.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which sort of, you know, allows for application to grant programs for the next phase of design.
Okay.
And then eventually permitting and construction.
Okay.
So most of these grant funded projects proceed in phases that are segmented out to allow for all the planning and permitting that has to go into them before we see shovels go in the ground.
Sure, yeah. Do you have a sense for a timeline here in Quincy?
You know, I think if the town was to go right from concept design to, say, apply for a CZM or some other grant funding to go into the next phase of design, probably 2 to 3 years before you could potentially see you know, the project actually being implemented.
Okay, all right. And are the, you know, once the project is complete, do you see the benefits pretty quickly, or does it take time?
You know, some of the time for the vegetation to fully establish probably a single growing season.
Okay.
And then those projects are generally adaptively managed, where we come back in and monitor the site for at least a year, sometimes several years, to see if, you know, post-planting, maybe there was a large storm event that caused some of that vegetation to get washed away. We'll generally have funding already set aside in the project to come in and reestablish some of that vegetation. This happened at Watson Park.
Oh,
there was
a
loss of some of the salt marsh vegetation, but because Woods Hole Group was monitoring the site, they were able to come right back in, reestablish that marsh vegetation, protect it from some of the geese that were also impacting it.
Right.
And now it's growing in really well and should be fully established at this point.
Okay. So, yeah, you'd hate to see all that work just be erased by one incident, you know.
Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing about Living Shorelines and a lot of nature-based approaches to resilience. You know, when you build a seawall or a bulkhead, the strongest day of its life is the day it's built. And then from there on out, you're seeing degradation. It's being chipped away at, and it's going to be really expensive to maintain and fix over the long haul. With a living shoreline, As it establishes, it gets stronger, the roots of native vegetation grow deeper and anchor the soils in place, and it grows and can move and adapt over time. So a living shoreline site like that can be completely flooded over, and you know, you may see some vegetation loss, but if there's good establishment, that site's very likely just to sort of be resilient and repair itself over the next 6 months to a year.
Sure.
Or with maybe a little helping hand and some seed or some other plantings, come right back to life. Really cost effective to, you know, do some adaptive management on a site like this,
yes,
versus having to replace a bulkhead wall that's sort of leaning forward and is now unstable and a threat to public safety.
Right. Now, the living shorelines, does it take place only on public lands or is it private lands as well, Dan?
So the Living Shoreline Planning Series is really focused on public spaces.
Okay.
You know, number one, we're using federal grant funding, so we sort of have this embedded responsibility to ensure that the projects going forward bring the broadest amount of benefit to the community. But you know, our hope is that these publicly accessible sites, some of which are owned and operated by nonprofits, but they're publicly accessible, can serve as sort of demonstrations to even private homeowners who live on the edge of a salt marsh who may think they need a bulkhead, but when they see a site like this and see it function, may decide to restore a natural slope and natural vegetation so that their dock is a place where ducks and fish and other things come in and thrive.
Well, the area we're talking about here in Quincy, Rock Island Cove, is a big birding area, I know.
Right.
Bird watchers like to spend time out there as well, so that would benefit that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But you can understand folks' initial reaction is, you know, I want to stop my property from being flooded, right? So what's the quickest and easiest way to do that? Put up a wall, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, most, like I said earlier, sort of the default solution for many years has been just to build a wall or a rock revetment. You know, those solutions are being recognized as harmful by the state. CZM and MassDEP are making those solutions harder to permit because they recognize the impact of widespread coastal hardening on wildlife habitat, on resilience, and on things that drive our economy, like fisheries. If all of the estuaries started to become hardened, that would actually become a threat to coastal fisheries, and it would be really expensive to maintain and upkeep over time.
Right.
Because these seawalls eventually will start to fail, especially as sea level rise starts to create overtopping and we see erosion back behind the seawall.
Yeah, you know, well, we are seeing that in Quincy as well. The Manhattan Avenue area of Housneck, for sure, is in the middle of a big seawall replacement project right now.
So, yeah, and I mean, coastal squeeze is an interesting problem. And as sea level rise continues to progress, I think, you know, some of these areas that we see along the Massachusetts coast, you know, that first row of houses at some point is going to become a really risky place to live. You know, we see the videos every year of Scituate and Cohasset with waves spraying up over the top of the houses. And at some point, the risk of living there becomes really high for residents. And maybe that first row of houses is a place where a living shoreline could actually provide a buffer zone to everybody else back behind and maybe even create a coastal amenity space where you have a restored dune system or a restored marsh with walking paths or other wildlife viewing areas or places for passive and active recreation that bring enormous value to the community. And I think the state right now is thinking about buyout programs for some of the most at-risk communities. But it's a difficult conversation.
Right.
You know, I look at my house in New Bedford and think this is a multi-generational house.
Sure.
My family's owned this house for, you know, 60, 80 years. And it's a really difficult decision to make. But I think the state and organizations like TNC are sort of preparing to help people make that decision and transition and then not leave that space in a state of disrepair, demolition.
Well, because then the second row of houses becomes vulnerable, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. So yeah. If we can, you know, think about that going forward in the future, I think it's difficult but important conversations.
Yeah. So what is the next step here in Quincy, Dan, for this project?
So there's a few more sessions in the Living Plan and Living Shorelines Planning Series to go. And then Woods Hole Group will basically work directly with the town to develop this concept design.
So the city has a director of coastal resiliency, actually, Margaret LaForest serves
right.
in that role.
So that process is sort of a give and take iterative process where, you know, the Woods Hole Group might say, well, this is what you should do. And then maybe Margaret comes back and says, yes, but we're also interested in this type of amenity, or we have this concern, and then Woods Hole Group will fall back, adjust the design to meet some of those desires, wants, and needs of the local community. And then maybe that concept design gets talked about at public meetings and gets even further, it further evolves as it goes forward into the permit level of design when area residents have had a chance to say a few things about what they'd like to see and how they'd like to see it implemented. And my hope is that this project will eventually set the stage for the work over on Rockland and Spring Streets, where we have that really complicated hydrology and two culverts sort of flowing into the same channel. That is a great future project that's much larger. And as the town and community residents learn more about the approaches being taken on Rota Street, that sets the stage for that other project to take place in the future.
Okay.
And then others, and then others, and then others.
Yeah, but it really is, it's a holistic approach. You're not coming in and just kind of shoving it down the community's throat, right? You're
right, absolutely, yeah. We want the community's input. We want to know what they'd like to see, what they value, and what individual impacts everyone's experiencing.
Yeah.
You know, the people who live in these communities, everywhere we go, we like to get out, engage, hold public talks, because it's only through the day in and day out observations of local residents that you really identify the true issues.
Yes.
You know, TNC and Woods Hole Group coming in for 1 or 2 days of site visits, we're just getting a snapshot.
Right.
You know, we really count on the community to give us the real ground truth.
All right. Well, we'll welcome you back to keep us updated on the project.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anything
really
else
excited.
You'd like to share with folks right now?
No, I mean, I think it's just really exciting to see the power of nature, you know, that it can protect us. We've done a lot to undermine its ability with sort of unbridled coastal development, but there are all sorts of places on the Massachusetts and New England coast where with just a few small adjustments or the restoration of a few small pieces of habitat that we could harness the power of nature to make our coasts a more resilient, safe place to live and also make space for wildlife and recreation and relaxation that really helps us balance our lives out and give us a place to rest and reflect.
Yeah. So if folks would like to ask questions or make some comments, they can email you directly, is that
right? And they can go to the link to the TNC's Living Shorelines page to find out more.
Okay, great. Great to talk to you, Dan. Really appreciate
absolutely.
The opportunity.
Fun. Thanks.
And do please come back. We'd love to kind of follow the story through.
Yeah, sure. Anytime.
And you're welcome. And thanks for watching us here at AM Quincy. I'm Joe Catalano, and we'll see you next time.